So usually the first sitting session after the lunch, it's quite normal for there to be a bit of sleepiness, but it's still good to do, to set that intention in a focused way, to generate mindfulness, to be in the present. And now I'd like to encourage people to do maybe 25 minutes of walking meditation and give you a few choices. You can practice the mindfulness of the feelings of the bottom of the feet as the main meditation if you like. You can also do it in conjunction with loving kindness if you like. So on the left foot, as you lift and still aware of the feelings, lifting and placing, you can think, may I be well. And then the right foot, you lift and you place, and you can think, may this person, my friend, be well, or may all beings be well. You can alternate like that with one footstep, may I be well. The other footstep, may this other person be well. You can practice loving kindness while you're walking. Or you can just be aware of those feelings as you lift the foot and then you place the foot. Notice that physical sensation. And we can use Buddho with this as well. In Thai tradition, when you place, you can do it when you lift, put, and when you place, do. Or you can just do it when you place, put on one foot, do on the other foot. Knowing, mindfully knowing. But one thing I'd like to ask everyone to do is every few rounds, find a small space, walking backwards and forwards. After doing that a few times, then just I want you to ask a sincere question. It's leading on to our contemplation we're going to do a bit later. I just want to ask yourself, is it possible? Is it possible that I could die today? Just ask yourself as a question, is it a possibility? And sincerely ask that question and just wonder about it. And then continue with your walking, lifting, placing, may I be well, may all beings be well. A couple more minutes later you might ask, is it possible? Is it possible? Could I die today? Could today be the day? And just ask yourself that question every now and then. And then I'll ring a bell at about 25 past, we come in for the remainder of the afternoon session. The Grim Reaper. So when I was a young monk, I think my second Pansa, my twin brother came to visit in Thailand. And at that time, he had a very big and very powerful Italian motorcycle. And I remember that motorcycle. I think I remember the previous one, because he picked me up from the airport when I was visiting my parents once, and when I was a layman. And I was sitting on the back of his new bike, and he was saying, so, do you want to see how fast it goes? And I said, oh, well, all right. And I think within a few seconds, we were going 220 kilometers an hour. And I thought, okay, yes, it's fast. But I remember thinking, I don't particularly want to die at this point in my life. And so then I went to Asia and became a monk, and he came to visit, and he'd got an even bigger bike, an even faster bike. And I thought, uh-oh. And so I was in Bangkok, and we were visiting some of those beautiful ancient temples in Bangkok. But also another thing that forest monks in Thailand sometimes do when they're in Bangkok is make a visit to a morgue, because in a Buddhist country this is tolerated, allowed. And so I said to my brother, I've got something to do this afternoon, would you like to come along? And he said, what is it? I said, well, you know, Buddhist monks, at that time we're just about to go off for the 2-month jungle retreat, so it's good to if you're a Gamatana bhikkhu, you want to meditate on death and dying, it's good to see some corpses, and then you recollect that memory of the bodies that you actually saw. So I was hoping to go and get some fresh images, and it was about 24 at the time, and you want to go to the jungle, and you're going to get enlightened, and you want to see tigers and all that, and I'm not enlightened yet anyway, but still trying. But anyway, so I was going to the morgue, and he said, okay. So he came. And no, I did have two intentions. I was pretty sure that there was going to be a motorcycle victim there. because every time I've been to the morgue, there has been. And so we were looking at these various bodies, and I said, Troy, his name is. And there was a young man. He had just one mark here where he'd fallen off his bike and he'd hit, I think, a post. And he looked perfectly healthy and quite good looking and young. I called my brother over. I said, Troy, look at him. He said, look at him. This was a motorcycle accident, I said to him. Really, and he's got the... That sometimes happens, the sweat gets on the brow and your face goes pale when you see these dead bodies. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to go outside now. I said, okay, you go outside. And it's very interesting what he did. He went to the shop, and within a couple of minutes he was talking to a young mother with a child. Now, from the point of view of someone cultivating mindfulness of death, this is very interesting, because there's that in the mind that wants youth and birth. And he found it within about 2 minutes. And he stuck to that and was already trying to forget that. But what happened was, when he came back to Australia, within not very long, he sold the bike and he bought a sensible Japanese sedan. And, now, I don't think to this day that he realizes that what was going on. I think it probably was a factor that he really saw, look, a young person who that morning didn't know that they were going to be dead by the afternoon. And I think he, you know, this is the heedfulness, isn't it? So another way to talk about heedfulness is to be careful. Heedful sounds a bit strange. So one who is careful, careful with their speech, careful with their thoughts, careful with what they do with their bodies, is one that's on the way to liberation. Another friend, we were in Nepal on pilgrimage with some Thai people, and this was many years later. And Nepal is predominantly Hindu. Well, it's about maybe 15% Buddhist. It's predominantly Hindu culture, and they have this small little creek which they believe eventually meets the Ganges. So that's where they burn their bodies. It's a muddy little creek, but anyway, and full of litter. But to them it's holy and sacred. And so they have these burning ghats, small burning ghats, and so I was with my Thai friends, and a couple of them were interested to go and see. There was this beautiful temple behind, actually a very beautiful temple, and Hindu music, and the kind of sadhus in their very orange robes. It was quite an exotic scene. And one woman didn't want to go. She was frightened of ghosts. And another man didn't want to go because he didn't want to see anything not beautiful. And I said, well, you don't have to go. That we are here and I'm going to go. And those other people in the tour who wanted to go, but they decided that they would go. So we all went together. And so she was sure that there was a ghost, but she, being a bit superstitious, and she was also sure that because there was a monk, it wouldn't be a problem. So, and so she came too. But what happened, now that changed her life, is that before then she didn't meditate or chant. But ever since that day, just going and seeing the truth of death, because there were a couple of corpses, you didn't see anything too ugly, there were nice bright cloths put on them and flowers sprinkled on them and people dancing. There was a bit of wailing and crying, and but overall it was, you know, it was quite beautiful, dignified, and beautiful ceremonies and some chanting and some ritual bathing. But just to see that body and say, okay, that's a dead body. And what something happens in that exchange, that there's a humbling, isn't there? A humbling of that assumption that this body, we assume that this one's just going to go on for a very long time, and that death will occur when we're very old. That's the assumption. But when we see a dead body, which looks just like other bodies, except for that absence of consciousness, it has an effect on us. It's like, yeah, right. I too am of this nature. It's also a phrase from the sutta that the Buddha said, I too am of this nature, thus I will become, thus the body will become. And ever since that day, she started to chant and meditate. So it's like you can see that kind of awareness of death can make people more heedful, more careful, more mindful. It's like you suddenly appreciate your life more. And as a monk, you hear many stories and you meet many people, you hear a lot about death. And so it's good in a way, it keeps your mindfulness of death contemplations going, keeps them fresh, there's always something to contemplate. Like, I'm just going to talk about a little of those experiences just because we're talking about death. So one is I knew when I met him actually, I think he was an 8-year-old boy who had a bone marrow disorder called thalassemia, which is occurring in cultures where there's a lot of malaria. A lot of malaria through generation, and then something goes wrong in the bone marrow that it can't produce red blood cells very well. So if you have that condition, you have to keep getting blood transfusions, and then you usually die prematurely. You die fairly young. But there's a process where you can decide to have a bone marrow transplant, and what happens is they have to take out all of the bone marrow and put in a close match, and then hopefully that bone marrow makes a red blood cell. So there's a 20% fatality rate. So by the time, I think he was about 11, that his parents decided, and they asked him, they said, okay, there's a 1 in 5 chance of death here. And they asked him, he was 11, what do you want? Do you want to have these continuing blood transfusions and a short life, or do you want to take the risk and possibly have a normal life? And the little boy, his name was Todd, decided to go ahead and have the procedure. And so, long story short, unfortunately, all of his bone marrow was removed, and new bone marrow was put in, and the body didn't accept it. And so we have this scenario of a very sweet, kind, good-natured boy who's going to die slowly because his body isn't producing red blood cells. And he did. He died in hospital, and it was very sad. So you just have this, who would think, if it had anything to do with this lifetime, who would think that nice little boy with that sweet character would be in that situation? But he was the 1 in 5. And what was interesting about this boy seemed to have quite a bit of good karma. He became a novice monk before this procedure for a little while. He paid respects to many monks, he was a Thai American, but when he visited Thailand, he would pay respects to some very good monks. And a couple of nights before he died, he dreamt of the most senior monk that he'd ever paid respects to. And that senior monk came in the dream. And behind that monk was all the other monks that he'd ever met. And they were chanting for him. And he told his mum, he said, Mum, Longpo Opat and Ajahn Anand and Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Acholo, they all came and they were all chanting for me last night. And she said, very good, Todd. That sense of even though he had to die, there was that sense of he probably went to a good situation. And then I lived in America some time ago, about 8 years ago, for a year and a half. And there was a neighbor in the branch monastery there, Abhayagiri. There was a neighbor. She had interesting karma. She used to be Catholic and then she became a Buddhist. And her husband used to be Catholic and he became a Buddhist. And her name was Mary. Some interesting karma. Their property, there was a Catholic monastery right next to the Buddhist monastery, and their property was on this parcel of land in between. So have this interesting Catholic Buddhist karma, and they were living between a Catholic monastery and a Buddhist monastery. But later in their life, they became practicing Buddhists, and at one stage, her husband died, and then she was alone for some time, and I think she was traveling. She used to teach conferences, I think business skills, management, something. She was wearing a cons teaching something, but she had a strange fever, and she wasn't hungry, and she felt feverish, but she didn't have any particular pain. But she did have a very high fever, and she wasn't sure what it was. And so, in ordinary waking consciousness, she's sitting in a chair, and she sees a being made of light approach her. She said, it looked like a Christian angel. Maybe her past karma, and said, Mary, you have a choice. You can die in 3 days, or you can go to the hospital. And so she went to the hospital, and it turned out that her appendix had burst, and that she was in process of the blood was slowly becoming poisoned, and the body was fighting those poisons with the fever. But basically, for whatever reason, she didn't have any feeling. When the appendix, not the usual aches and cramps and abdominal, no warning at all, just a very high fever. And so, sure enough, she went to the hospital, they took some blood tests, they just said, oh, well, and they very quickly got her into surgery. And she did survive on that occasion. But once again, what happened after that was she realized that, in terms of what people, Buddhists, want to make good karma, in terms of the property that she had, it wasn't clear what she was going to do with it. And so within a couple of months, I think she changed the will. And later on, she died in that house, and the monks and the lay women and people were tending on her. She was able to die in that house of colon cancer, I believe, in her late 70s. But she left that house to the monastery, and it became the lay women's accommodation. So it's just that sense of awareness of death as well. It also makes people bring into focus, this thing that I have when I die, what can I do that will make it useful? And how can I make a little bit extra good karma before that happens? So again, that experience helped her, and I believe she made some good karma. And obviously she was very well taken care of up to the very last moment. I heard another story recently, I won't mention any names, but I heard a story of a woman who had a serious lung infection and had collapsed lungs, and then had to have serious drug sedation, and for a period of a couple of weeks in a semi-coma-like state. And when I talked with her, she said that she could see all these grey energies and snake-like beings around for that period that she was in that semi-coma. And that's very interesting. And I was talking with her, and she said that she had been a little bit depressed and a little bit angry before having this chest infection. And one could deduce that that's possibly the mind which is about to take birth in a ghost realm or a naga realm. So it's just one of the things I just mentioned. These are like real-life stories that people tell monks, that one person seeing an angel saying, "Mary, go to the hospital." Another one seeing these snakes and these ghosts. It's just to be mindful. The benefits of practicing death meditation is that when the time comes to die, that if you're aware that today could be the day that you die, you want to keep your mind as bright as possible, and as a practice of forgiveness. This is very important. Is when it comes, if we have enough mindfulness to know when the time of death approaches, that we recollect our refuge at that time. So if while we're dying we can remember that the Buddha is our refuge, this is very powerfully protecting. And it's good to have given some thought, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow again. I like to talk also about refuge. It's good to give some thought about what refuge is. So all of us here have done a lot of chanting, read a lot of books, doing quite a bit of meditation. So, you know, you do have the Dhamma as your refuge. You're walking the path towards realizing truth. And then I think you really can take the Buddha as a refuge. So what does that mean? That his example of liberation, that you have the potential to be liberated. And then the enormous amount of merit that bodhisattvas produce in their process to become a Buddha, that's huge. So the Buddha's merit is enormous. The Buddha's boundless. So it's like that has a protective influence if we can recollect it. So we have to recollect at this time when we're dying what the refuge is. You can recollect the Buddha's beautiful qualities. Just think about boundless compassion. So if the Buddha had boundless compassion, that includes even you. And so sometimes we forget that. It's like a boundless compassion is that the Buddha's compassion included everyone and maybe not me. But if we have a kind of a grudge against ourselves, as some of us do, but we have to really contemplate the fact that the Buddha was the kindest being that ever walked on the planet. The friendliest being that ever walked on the planet. And so sometimes you can read in these suttas that that he can seem a stern and scolding character at times, and I'm sure he could have been, if to be so would have been useful in that moment. There's also many other occasions where he was extraordinarily kind. You have examples of yakas or demons saying, "Hey, shaven head, answer this question or I'll throw you on the other side of the river." And he says, "Well, I can't see anyone in samsara that could do that, but ask me your question anyway." And then he answers the question to this demon, and the demon becomes very impressed and goes for refuge. There's stories like this. And then he would screen the world with his divine eye in the morning and see if there was anyone that was ripe for liberation, and sometimes walk 20 miles to teach one person. So this is the Buddha. He wasn't vain, he wasn't arrogant, he wasn't... Nothing was too much. If he thought he could liberate one being, he would walk 20 miles personally. That's very beautiful. So that's the kindness of the Buddha. So as we're dying, hopefully we can recollect that the Buddha is a very, very kind being. He's like the symbol, and I say he, but actually it's beyond gender. The Buddha had no sexual craving anymore. I'm sure he didn't perceive himself as either male or female, but he was purified. His mind was pure. So it's like his merit is enormous, his kindness, his compassion was boundless. And I think if we recollect that, a certain amount of that merit is we might be able to tap into it somehow, in as much as it has a brightening effect on our mind. That when we think of the Buddha's merit, our own mind brightens. We think of the Buddha's kindness, his wisdom, his capacity to train. This is important. So the ways to do this, of course, traditionally are chanting. Now, many of us do this iti piso, but then we have to contemplate the meaning of those words. And so that when it's time to go, that we can recollect the Buddha, we can those familiar words, and hopefully people around us will be chanting them. And when they're chanting them, if we are living in a Buddhist community, other people will be chanting these words. And when they're chanting them, we want to know what they mean. Vijja charana sampanno, impeccable, perfect in conduct and in understanding. That's very beautiful. Absolutely pure, purified by himself. These various phrases, the meanings of that small verse that we chant. Just wondering if I've got any more interesting death stories. I'm sure I do. Oh, that's right. I have one friend who didn't believe in karma for a long time. But he had a friend. This is also in America. He had a friend who was driving home from work one day, and a pine tree branch broke, smashed through the windscreen, and entered her heart and killed her. And it's like, so I know it's a horrible story, but for him, it's like the only way that that could make sense is karma. That being must have taken lives before, must have killed before. For a pine tree to break at that moment, land through the windscreen at that angle, and go perfectly in the in the heart. Well, we had a similar story in Australia, didn't we? Mr. Steve Irwin. And I remember Ajahn Anand saying, "Atalo, Mani, come here." I said, "Kapatan?" He goes, "Steve Irwin, crocodile man, die now." He's dead. He said, "The whole of Australia is sad because Steve Irwin is dead." I said, "How did he die?" And they told me the story. Now, some of these teachers have some remarkable skills, and apparently, according to what the venerable monk could see, Steve Irwin didn't have negativity in his mind when he died. But apparently, he had harmed that particular stingray in a past life. And so then it ripened under the water with a mind of appreciation. But because he'd harmed that being, which just happened to have a very, very poisonous bar in its tail, and you see, oh. So this is this thing about when we think we're not sure, maybe it's not possible that we could die today. It's definitely possible. There are any number of strange and interesting ways that we could die. And so we train in mindfulness of death, one, to be more heedful with our life, two, so that when death comes, we won't be too taken by surprise, to be ready to recollect the good things that you've done, ready to drop the negativities, recollect the refuge, to be able to do it within a few seconds. And then also as this ongoing training awareness of impermanence, which is central to our practice as Buddhists, because training the awareness of impermanence helps us to let go of our attachments. And of course, when we have deep insights into impermanence, we can realize the deathless, the heedful, and the heedful never die. So once we become truly heedful of this truth of impermanence, we can be liberated from the realm of death. So we keep training in that. And so invite you to close your eyes now. Once again, aware of the in-breath, aware of the out-breath.